Oh, my guest this week, ladies and gentlemen, simply requires no introduction. He is, of course, Mr. W.M. Brown's style himself, Matt Rannick. I've known Matt for a number of years now and have always had a huge amount of respect for his work. I've also borne witness to his stratospheric rise with diverse projects like his editorial website, the W.M. Brown Journal, his new print magazine and his book, A Man and His Watch, all going from strength to strength. Quite apart from the fact that Matt is a stand-up guy, I was intrigued to find out just how he juggles all of these different projects, and to learn a little bit more about his route through the industry. We discuss the different hats he wears, from photographer to magazine editor, his diverse tastes and passions, and of course his interest in heritage brands. Here's what we discovered. All right, well, Mr. Rannick.
Nice
here
to see
we
you.
Are. Yeah, good to see you too. Thanks for taking some time out.
Sure.
Busy man that you are. We've just been talking about your next issue is about to take up a bit of your time.
Yeah.
Lots going on. But I've got tons to talk to you about.
Okay, great.
I'm so intrigued.
I'm a great first date, so it's the second one that you have to worry about.
Right, yeah. Let's hope we get through this.
Yeah.
So, where are we going to begin? I wanted to ask with a big, expansive question, because you are such a kind of an influential figure in the industry and in our little kind of menswear bubble now, and you do so many different things. How do you see yourself today?
As a street hustler, pretty much. I mean, this has been such a great journey, and I have to say, navigating this kind of menswear world is really inspiring. Like, I am very, very inspired by the characters that I have been lucky enough to surround myself with. I've always been interested in it. I had my start in the photography end of the business first, and always kind of gravitated to fashion, and then realized that it's not about fashion, it's really about style, and it's about individual style. And that's what I like about navigating this world. And that was sort of the inspiration for Wayne Brown.
Right. Okay. So let's unpick this a little bit. Because you were originally a photographer. That was your first professional love.
I still put that on my customs form.
Right.
Because you're sort of like, what is this other stuff?
Yeah.
So it was just easier just to be photographer.
I get that because since I've gone freelance and I'm now all of a sudden a journalist and a podcaster and a consultant of stuff. It's like, how do you... There's something about saying, oh, yeah, I'm a content consultant, which makes you sound like an absolute...
A friend of mine used to always just put artist.
Very good.
Which is a very vague, broad
Bohemian.
Term.
Bohemian.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So this journey that you have been on begins, of course, with the William Brown Project.
Yeah.
Why don't we take a little bit of a step back and kind of trace some of that through... How did William Brown come to be a thing?
Okay, so I had a reasonably prolific commercial photography career.
Yeah.
And as I was navigating that world, it was Yolanda, actually, who said, you have to start doing a blog. Because I had all this residual stuff coming back from stories and traveling and, you know, and she was like... And I'm a big fan of the oral tradition. And she was like, and I'm not a big journaler. And it was Yolanda who said, like, you need this, all these things need to live somewhere. And there's a thing called a blog now.
Yeah.
And you can do this and da 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 da. And I was like, oh, I don't have time. Like, one more thing. And then I think Yolanda did my first two blog posts.
So she
was like, here you go.
Yeah.
Now you take it from here. And it became the William Brown Project. For two reasons. One, it needed to have a title and a name different than Matthew Horanic Photography, right? Which had a commercial space, had a website, had an agency, blah, blah, blah. And I also wanted it to be slightly more anonymous. So my farm that we have in upstate New York is on William Brown Road. And it's part of William Brown Farm, which in the turn of the last century was a massive dairy farm.
Right.
And a lot of the stuff I was talking about in the blog was a little bit kind of like city mouse, country mouse. And a lot of it was happening there. It was incubating there. And I was like, well, why don't we just call it the William Brown Project?
Right.
And at that time also, I was making illegal charcuterie with some pigs we were raising.
There you go.
And a friend of mine had this tiny little wine and cheese shop in the little local town. And I had brought him some rillettes or something. And he was like, dude, we got to sell this in this shop. And I said, well, it's not a USDA kitchen. He's like, I'm never inspected. Don't worry about it. But I need a label. So we did this label that was kind of a riff off the logo of St. John Food and Wine. So just this profile of a pig, silhouette of a pig. And I wrote William Brown Farms, ingredients, our pigs, their fat, spices. And that went on everything.
That was great.
And then it kind of just solidified this kind of quote. I don't know, it's not really a brand, but this idea. And then William Brown kind of took on this other identity, which could have been very, very separate from my professional one.
And as we sort of trace this early development of your kind of, I guess, editorial career back then, at what point in your life did you get into hunting, fishing, cooking in a certain way? When did your kind of interest in good living emerge?
That was always a part of my DNA. Like, my father and mother were both first-generation immigrants.
Right.
My father's family from Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. Czechoslovakia, Russia.
Yeah.
And my mother's side, all Italians. So the food stuff was just through osmosis, right? The food stuff was about growing up in kitchens,
yeah,
and just being around all those powerful women in the kitchen and paying attention because I liked it. And then my dad was a bit of a kind of country squire and was a really, really big wing shooter, duck hunter specifically, and fly fisherman.
Right. So it's just all osmosis.
It was just it's all the only things I knew.
Right.
And, you know, I was a big fan of all those women, so I paid attention in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a big fan of what my dad did and how he approached it, which was in a very conscientious, thoughtful, and often stylish way. And I kind of nerded out with all that. And so when I moved to New York, you know, all of a sudden I'm immersed in this urban world, right? Working in a lot of editorial high-end fashion, and I was assisting photographers with Vanity Fair and Vogue. And I was like, what happened to that upstate guy?
Yeah, he just disappeared.
He disappeared. And then at that point, I kind of reassessed the balance of things. And there was a group of photographers who were all sort of thinking the same thing. And we all started fly fishing together again.
Oh, right. So it was so almost there was like a little club.
Yeah. And then some of us kind of branched off and started wing shooting again. And all of a sudden, I was like, this is what I've been missing. This is the balance that I've missed. And of course, the hunting thing was a big... The point of that was a lot about, of course, nerding out on gear and stuff like that. But it was about food source and food sourcing and understanding wild foods. And, you know, in America, we don't have any wild foods available to us.
Mm.
In the UK, you do have wild foods because it's managed differently. But it was important for me to connect back to that.
Yeah.
Which also connected back to my family and my father and that journey.
It's so interesting. I didn't know that about your parents, but it's so interesting how these things impact us.
Well, I mean, for that generation and also for a lot of my grandparents who survived the American Depression, they were,
sure.
You know, they emigrated in 1911, 1912.
Oh, so right they went straight
there.
Through it.
And then, so I remember my grandfather on the Italian side, prolific garden. Early on, I remember chickens, but that was short-lived.
Mm.
And then on the Czech side, a lot of kind of, you know, my grandfather was a big deer hunter. So like all of that turned into charcuterie. And it was just it was just what you did to survive in a weird way. And it just became part of the cultural vernacular in terms of food. And I was always interested in food. And quite interested in those two ethnic journeys because it was pretty prolific in my hometown. It was an industrial revolution town.
Right.
And all these immigrants came to work for a little brand called IBM that started there. And then there was an amazing shoe factory there at the time that both of my grandfathers made shoes at.
Ah, okay.
And it was an amazing, you know, immigrant communities are great in terms of the diversity of culture that they bring to a place and unify in this idea of being an American an Italian-American, a Czech-American. And I paid attention to that, and I liked that. And I still go back to, my mother still lives in that town in upstate New York.
Right.
And I love going back there.
Awesome.
It's great.
Really, really cool. Now, let me continue with this thread. So you launched the WM Brown Project. Two questions to come off of that. One, did you ever expect that it would balloon in the way it did? And two, when did clothes start to creep into the equation?
You know, it was a necessity for me to kind of have that dialogue and to kind of create that stuff. You know, I think as photography changed, and it was less about craft and more about like this digital thing that made things easier, more people could do it, it was cheaper. The landscape of how photography was happening changed dramatically. And I saw the writing on the wall with that. And I was thinking to myself, you know what, I like being a photographer, I like the execution of ideas, but moreover, I like the creation of ideas, and I like the kind of content idea. And I knew possibly that there was 10 guys behind me that could probably shoot that same picture, but there probably wasn't 10 guys behind me that could come up with the idea for the picture. And that's when I started changing my point of view. And then I think style and clothes were always a big part of it, but it didn't become a bigger dialogue until I kind of fine-tuned who I was confident enough to say I was,
right,
which was basically an upstate New York preppy with slightly better versions of the clothes he wore in high school.
Right.
Right? So, you know, I'm a big fan of the uniform. I think most men of a certain age need to find their stride and stick with it. And because I watched the men in my life the same way, you know, kind of identify that way. So that was the sort of trajectory of how it shifted from this photography career to this kind of content career.
Right.
In the early days of, you know, every Condé Nast magazine suddenly wanted to like have a website, but no one knew how to do it. Or Brand X wanted a website, a digital element with content, but nobody knew how to do it. Well, I was always this ideas guy. Like I would come back from photo assignments in the glory days of legacy publishing.
Yep.
And I'd say, I know I was in Costa Rica covering a fly fishing trip, but you know, there's an amazing little hotel and a great little restaurant. That's just a, and editors will look at me and say like, you know, we have people to do this. Like we don't need your ideas. And I just was so, I don't know. I was just so disappointed by that.
Yeah.
And then I realized with the digital space, there was this need for 24 hours of content. And I had it. I had it because I was just constantly observing and absorbing and wanting to tell the story of stuff that I kind of fell in love with. So the first people to really tap into that was American GQ because they just launched. And they said, we would just like you to keep posting on our blog. And I was like, well, how many posts? And they're like, how many can you do? And I was like, I could do 4 a day if you want. And they paid me a la carte. So it was to my advantage.
Wow.
Like they had no idea. They were paying like editorial magazine rates for blog posts. And I was just like, what a great revenue stream. They got hip to that real quick. You know, that did not last. But I really, really loved it. And I also loved the dialogue of supporting brands that I was finding that I really liked. So if it was a little mom and pop bicycle brand or some sock or some bar, like it suddenly I had a voice to say, hey, go check this out and support this and be a part of this.
Yeah.
And that to me, like the magazine and having those relationships, that's exciting to me because I think collective success, inclusiveness of that success, everybody wins.
Yeah.
You know,
but also, and I guess this is a big part of the magazine, which we're about to come on to, is there are very few individuals in the media right now who are in a position to just find something cool and honestly just tell it, just go for it. Because we all know the media brands have huge costs that they're struggling to deal with, and there are structures and there are publishers that are saying to journalists, no, you can't do that because you've got to do this, etc. You know, the fact that you don't have that is very rare and very exciting from a reader perspective, as well as presumably from your own perspective.
Yeah. Well, I came from that world. I mean, I really kind of grew up at Condé Nast in Hearst and navigating all these magazines as first a photographer.
And I presume that's where you met your wife, Yolanda, as well.
I actually met Yolanda at a bar on Houston Street when a group of people from LA who were working for Guess Jeans at the time.
Oh, right.
It's a much more complex, long story. But Yolanda was working in L.A. at Guess, and a friend of mine was shooting the campaign, and they were all in town for a shoot, and that's where we met. And then Yolanda quickly started navigating the magazine world. She had lived in New York and worked for Elle magazine, left, moved back to California, and then she got back into it after I convinced her to move to New York.
Right.
But, you know, so we both, Yolanda and I both kind of grew up as our first jobs in the magazine world and navigating it. And I loved the magazine world. I found it romantic and exciting and inspiring. And the people around were eccentric and glorious and bigger than life. And
yeah,
it was magic for me. And, you know, as I watched the kind of dismantling of that and also it being fueled not by kind of creative and single-minded ideas, but just the commerce of it, which before they didn't have to worry about the commerce of it. The money just came.
Yeah.
But as that got stricter and more constricting, I just was like, this is so ridiculous and boring.
Can I ask you a sort of a side note question? Because I'm fascinated to get the opinions of individuals like you who lived through it. What would you say to a young journalist now or someone who wants to be a journalist in terms of going into the magazine landscape? Would you advise that they do it or not do it?
Well, starting out in the magazine world, even in the kind of glory days of publishing, there wasn't a lot of currency behind it. That's why, like, most Vogue editorial assistants were, like, from wealthy families,
sure,
right? There
sure
was never... But I think what the takeaway of all that was, once you paid your dues, there was this escalation, there was this place to go. That, I think, is more difficult now. I think those jobs are not there.
Yeah.
We see the dismantlement of legacy publishing in New York and all these kind of great old school editors. There's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So I think, listen, you follow what you love, full stop. If that's magazines, then find the magazine that's going to listen to you and take your voice. If it's, I don't know, selling shoes or slinging burgers, whatever that is, I think you follow what you love. And I did. And I didn't really know anything else. Mm-hmm. So that's how this kind of idea developed, because I didn't want it to go away. And I didn't want all these kind of amazing, talented friends, writers, photographers, lose this kind of tangible format to see their work. That's why in the first issue, when I just reached out to people and I was like, you need to give this to me for free. They were like, great. We want to be a part of this.
Mm.
And that's still a bit of my business profile right now, unfortunately. But it's great to give people a forum and a voice, unadulterated, unedited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a photographer working for the mag, I mean, I've been there.
Yeah.
You do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah.
If you're writing words, you write exactly. If we've given you the thumbs up, then give
get
me.
Get on and do it.
Do what I admire about you. And I think that that's a real pleasure with all that.
Stylish folk, a cheeky reminder that season 3 of Handcut Radio is sponsored by Thomas Mason, an historic fabric mill and supplier of luxury shirting cloth to the most famous names in menswear. Moreover, to give you the chance to experience the exceptional fineness of Thomas Mason's fabrics firsthand, we've partnered with Thomas Mason and Turnbull & Asser on a competition for you. We're offering two readers the opportunity to win 3 free bespoke shirts each, made up by the marvellous team at Turnbull & Asser in any Thomas Mason bespoke fabric of your choosing. This offer is redeemable at Turnbull's London Davies Street or New York store, and the two winners will be chosen at random and notified at the close of Season 3. To be in with a chance to win, simply visit handcutradio.com/Thomas Mason and sign up with your email address. It's a hell of a prize, this, if I do say so myself, so please don't miss the chance to enter. That's handcutradio.com/Thomas Mason. Thanks, as always, for listening. Now we'll crack on with your podcast. Awesome. So, at the time of recording, you are close to getting a fourth issue out the door to the printers.
Yeah.
How have you found this trajectory? I mean, it's W.M. Brown magazine seems to have just taken our world by storm.
Well, that's very sweet to hear that. I mean, I think it has a very honest, authentic voice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could punch many holes in it unless you just are a very mean person. Because it comes from an honest place. Like, all this stuff I love, all this stuff comes from, listen, it's a magazine with a lot of frivolity and it's not changing the world, but it's people and things that I really like.
It's with heart.
And it's with heart. And it was the men's magazine that I always wanted. Like, I loved reading Gourmet for the food, and I loved a little Hooks and Bullets magazine in the local supermarket, and I loved reading GQ, but why wasn't it all under one umbrella that kind of talked about all those things that we call lifestyle, and I just called like a way of life, right? And then I figured, if I'm into it, maybe I'm not alone. So let's build this thing with a very specific selfish point of view.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that it's resonated, and I'm glad that I'm not alone.
The thing that I think does resonate, I'm kind of discovering more and more the longer I'm in this industry as it continues to change, because it's changed, you know, I've only been doing it for 5 years, and I feel like I'm constantly battling against changing media landscape as a young journalist, is you... The singularity of vision is what gives the magazine its strengths, right? Because I am really unconvinced by a lot of the lifestyle titles in our space that try and dip into things to please everyone. You know, W.M. Brown doesn't try to do that. W.M. Brown presents, as we've already said, your honest vision of life. And I actually wouldn't, personally, I wouldn't call it a lifestyle title, because I think talking about it in terms of it being your approach to life is way more powerful and current. I love that. I mean, would you say there is a power to being a niche brand today?
Yes, because I think we've seen the failings of generalist view.
Right.
When magazines started chasing the money.
Yeah.
And they needed to become everything for everyone.
Mm.
That's when it failed.
And that's the problem. Do you consider the mainstream publishing landscape to have now failed at this point in time?
I mean, all I see is some of the most talented people I've ever met in my life being dismantled from jobs because nobody really cares anymore. That's a failure that nobody cares. There was a time when imagery was being celebrated. The best journalists were writing for titles. And there are pockets of stuff out there. Like, I still love The New Yorker and The Economist.
Yeah.
But where are those kind of great visual volumes? Like, they're out there in the independent world, but they've lost their way in the legacy world, I think, because of that kind of generalist view.
Mm.
I said to myself early on, like, I'm not interested in 100% of the market. That's not realistic. I'll take 12% of the market. That's a very specific point of view. And now that there's all this noise out there with the digital space, I think, and I'm finding, that there's all these brands kind of gravitating to William Brown because it has a very single point of view. It does have a view that if you are that type, you will identify with, and that audience will be quite specific.
Mm.
And it's much easier to manage for me. And I'm finding that, thankfully, it's a successful approach. At least right now.
Well, it's just, you're not forcing anything, are you? For starters, it's just all natural. You look for the ideas and they're going to be there because you're interested and you're engaged and you know what you're doing. I used to struggle at previous kind of in-house magazine jobs being forced to write about subject matter that I just didn't, you know, why would you get me to write about cars? I know nothing about cars.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I agree with that. And, you know, I've become really an accidental journalist, right? Like, I was not trained. I'm a slow, lazy writer. I'm heavily top edited. But if I'm in love with something, if I'm passionate about something, it's very easy for me to talk about it. So that means very easy to translate that into words because it's just talking on paper. But, you know, I did this watch book, A Man and His Watch, right?
Yes, so suddenly, which is great.
Thank you. And that was really about just talking to people about the objects that they liked. But then suddenly I was like being asked to write introduction to books and talk about brands and all this other stuff for pay.
Mm.
And I was like, oh my God, this sucks. Because if I didn't like them, or if I didn't know enough about it, or if I needed to talk in somebody else's voice, it was really, really painful. It
becomes a chore.
It becomes work.
Yeah.
And I think what I don't do now is work. This is not work. This is a life and a career, and it's fun. And I think once stuff becomes not fun, then it's work, and then it's painful.
Yeah, you're in trouble. Can we talk a little bit about watches?
Yeah.
What is it that gets you fired up about timepieces?
I think what I think the connections to timepieces and people is first my connection. Like, my dad wore a Rolex Datejust, and James Bond wore a Rolex Submariner, and I wanted to be both of those guys. And, you know, astronauts wore Omega Speedmasters, and, like, you know, it became this kind of identifier.
Mm.
And I just aesthetically like them. Like, I mentioned cars. Like, I adore cars. I love their sense of design. I'm not a mechanical person. Like, I don't know. I know basically how a watch works and basically how a car works. But I'm not going to be the guy, you know, on the side of the road with the hood up going, like, what's the matter with my car? It's like, yeah. It's a call AAA. I'm not that guy. So I like, first and foremost, the kind of aesthetic of watches.
Mm-hmm.
And then I like kind of what they represent and how you present yourself to the world a little bit about what choices you've made, if it's a Cartier or Rolex or Omega or whatever.
Mm.
And you could tell a lot about a person, I think, with the kind of wrist wear and shoes. The kind of decisions they're making.
Yeah, there needs to be a book or a series for me or something about interpreting a personality from a watch. I love that idea of going, okay, well, if he's wearing this, then that would be quite fun.
Yeah.
I quite like that idea.
I more often than not, you're usually spot on.
Right.
You know, you see the kind of big kind of Russian oligarch with the giant 50 millimeter guild. You're like, I know exactly what that guy's about.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. I wanted to kind of broaden out the conversation a little bit and ask what you're into at the moment. What brands or like restaurants or what's on your radar right now that's good?
Well, I think as I get older, and I'm getting older, it's about this simplification of things. Like, I just want to trim the fat,
right?
So I think with food, I'm eating the best ingredients the most simple way. That makes me the happiest. Like, give me a toast and a cappuccino for breakfast. That's heaven to
me. That's really good.
Right, a great mortadella on a little panino. Like, that's heaven. And I think I'm navigating food in restaurants that, like, celebration of, like, great ingredients and simple, mm-hmm. less foam. You know, more freshness. And then I think with clothes, I feel the same way. I think that gravitating to heritage brands has always kind of been something I'm interested in. The classics. There's not a lot of new designers per se that I find a kind of kindred relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself going back to Levi 501s, simple cashmere roll necks,
yeah.
old heritage brands that have a history that are making slight style tweaks. I think Grenfell is one of those,
right? It's a good example, yeah.
And, you know, I like a lot what Drake's does in that trad world. I mean, I'm, again, very selfishly focused in what I feel comfortable of where I came from. And then I think now I gravitate a lot to the kind of smaller Neapolitan brands and the Italian brands. They just speak to me, the construction and things like that.
It just makes sense.
It makes sense. But, you know, my fantasy would be I would just be that guy in a pair of 501s and a V-neck Hanes t-shirt, which maybe that happens once in a while, but it's not my reality.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I wonder where we go from here. I wanted to ask whether you can give us a little teaser of what's coming in the next issue.
More bartenders.
Great.
More kind of influential men of style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, inspiring characters. I think, you know, we're approaching this in an ageless way, right? There's spectacular 80-year-old old-school characters that are equally as aspiring as kind of younger, influential, you know, men that I'm running across. Mm. So, like, that 18 to 80 demographic is what we're going after.
Right.
Right? That's where it gets broad. But it's usually people of very similar, like-minded points of view.
Exactly. So it's a mindset. It's not a...
Yeah. And that is, you know, new school and old school. And so I think there's more of that. I think I want to bring in more food to the magazine.
Cool. Do you know what my favorite thing is? The Chef's Midnight Snacks.
Oh.
It's such a great idea.
So you know how this happened. I was trying to figure out what I wanted in the first issue.
Mm.
And I was jet lagged. Right. I was from a trip. I woke up in the middle of the night and I was like, body clock was way off, hungry, nothing in the house. And I was like, midnight snack. Like, what would Jack Pepin make for midnight snack? Now, I thought about two chefs straight away, Eric Repair and Jacques Pepin, two people that I deeply admire. And I have both of their emails because I had worked on a project separately, both of them. So I got up and I wrote to Jacques Pepin. I said, Jacques, do you have a midnight snack? Can you let me know what that is? And can I have the recipe? And I did the same thing to Repair. I woke up, first email was a response from Jacques Pepin. And he said, you know, Matt, I don't have the recipe, but I like bourbon and dark chocolate. And I was like, that is what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
You know, there was a book not too long ago called Last Meals. Now, Last Meals, Chef's Last Meals, I mean, that's really rooted in fantasy, right? Mm. You could be like, oh, my last meal. Okay, I want to bring Paul Bocuse back from the dead and do this fantastic meal and, you know, this fantasy, right?
Sure.
But I really like the way, I mean, I was really, really lucky early in my photo career to work with a lot of chefs. I was working with Food and Wine and Gourmet a lot. And it was kind of great to get into the mind of these amazing characters. And I thought, this is true insight into the chef. Mm. Like, what is the thing when you dismantle all this world that is available to them? What is the thing that in their most vulnerable time, their most guttural time, most primitive sense, what are they going to eat?
Yeah.
Because we all been there.
When you strip everything away.
Yeah. Then there's nothing, or you come back from a trip and there's nothing in the house. And so I love that series. And I'm going, that's one thing. There will be some variations. Like, we don't always have a bespoke section, or we may change the interior section. I want to keep it spontaneous. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's going to be these sections that you always know will be there. Like, we always alternate with the hook and the hunt.
Yeah.
You know, seasonally. But I think Midnight Snack, I don't want that to go away.
No, it's brilliant. It's absolutely awesome.
Thank you.
I love it. I get a lot. I also think it's very, very, it's a testimony to how powerful the magazine is when one page can hook you in so strongly. Ah. You know, I don't read a lot of print media right now where I'm like, that's a great page. That's a great page. That's a great page. Yeah, I think it's super cool.
That's very. That means a lot to me.
It is true.
Thank you.
A couple more questions for you, just as we wrap up a little bit. I wondered whether you had any thoughts on where menswear is at more generally, and what you're seeing that is good or bad, or anything that needs to change or evolve.
You know, I was a kid of the 80s, and there was a big trend in the 80s of like everyone wearing either a Fila or Tikini or Adidas tracksuit. Mm-hmm. And it identified a very specific character. And I understand and respect the value of what the street presents in terms of style and how, you know, how the street finds its way. But I think, like, seeing middle-aged men in high-end branded tracksuits and streetwear in this kind of urban, like, keep the urban to the generation that is changing the course of style.
Yeah.
Like, that I love. And I could be on the train in, you know, in full bespoke corduroy and appreciate the kid who walks on with real street style. Mm. But as bigger fashion houses start kind of appropriating that, I find that really discouraging.
Yeah.
And I also think that you know, I'm much more interested in just kind of timeless style. You know, like, I think there's nobody more stylish than, like, Melanie's cab drivers with their fishing vests and good haircuts. And, you know, like, I like those kind of characters. I mean, there is a place in, when I was covering men's fashion shows for Condé Nast Traveler, when I was the men's editor there, I'd be in some of these shows going, like, what the hell is this theater, or are they really, like, what? I was confused, and people be like,
where is the consumer in all this? That's what confuses me.
Like, yeah, like Tom Brown, who I love, like sending guys out in like sleeping bag skirts, you know, are they just selling jumpers at the end of the day? Like, yeah. I found it was very confusing to me. I didn't understand it. But navigating this world, like PT in this kind of more traditional heritage, you know, I understand that because I came from that, and I like that, and I think that will always have longevity and influence, and I don't know, I think it's the right way to go.
It's just not going anywhere, is it? It's been around.
It shouldn't go
long
on. Yeah, like, you know, you're wearing a denim shirt that has probably been built like that since the 1930s.
Totally.
And guess what? They're right.
Yeah.
You know, there's just some things that are right.
Yeah.
You know, an asymmetrical patchwork, you know, long jumper with a zipper, like, no effing way.
Incidentally, why do you think some of these big global brands are trying to appropriate streetwear?
I think they're chasing the fast money.
Right.
They see the markets that are interested in it. They're spending big money. There's a very high-end sticker price on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the biggest tragedies I've ever seen is, like, I walked in a couple of years ago to the Dunhill shop, which I'm a huge Dunhill fan. And, like, all of a sudden I was like, wait, blue jeans and ripstop camo anoraks?
It's completely lost its way for me. It's a brand that I think's really gone off the rails. Happy to say
someone
that on the
save Dunhill.
Yeah.
I did this hashtag just as a joke that said, make Dunhill great again.
Yeah. It's true.
But, you know, there's a perfect example of kind of chasing this generalist view, in my opinion, that is reflective of, like, market share. You know, there's a reason why brands like Hermès have just plugged away and, you know, definitely innovated. But, you know, it didn't really divert much from the path.
No, it's a 3% and then a 3% and then a 3% instead of these mad pendulum swings in taste and offering and targets. Yeah.
So that's my discouragement with that. I mean, that being said, some of these brands that are making these kind of outlandish garments do have very kind of traditional tailoring legs as well, which is still kind of quite beautiful, and, you know, but they're not telling that story.
No, it gets lost.
It's good. Yeah.
I have one more question for you. I've kind of already asked this, but I'm interested to ask a different spin on it, because we often ask guests this. What would you say to someone who wants to do what you do? What advice, if you could give one piece of advice to a young hopeful, what would it be?
You know, I assisted many years ago this photographer, Horst P. Horst, okay? A real icon. And when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, I remember saying to Horst, like, what would be your advice to me? Like, there was a lot of noise influencing my photographic point of view. And he had this weird kind of international accent. And he was of German birth, but had a slight British tone to it. And he said, do what you love, baby. And I was like, he's like, you know, you'll find your way if you kind of just do what you love. And I really, really, really agree with that. And, you know, I'm a hustler. I'm a street hustler. Like, I spend a lot of time trying to make things work. You know, I always have this saying with my wife, it's like, things normally always work out for the best, right? You may think that you've hit this wall or there's this curveball, but just, like, take advantage of that and shift it into your world. Like, I think I'm very, very optimistic. I think I'm a glass half full kind of guy. I don't like negativity. In my house, I despise the word no. Like, I can't accept no. I just want to turn all of that stuff into yes, and it's possible, and let's make it happen. And I think that's what I did with the magazine, is like I visualized it. I was really lucky enough to have a very tight internal support system, and being surrounded with support is always very, very, very helpful. You're not alone. Mm-hmm. And then you just do it. And if it falls on its face, you get up and you try something else.
Great. I think we've got our headline for this episode. Matt Pranick is a street hustler. love it.
Great. I'll make sure I wear tighter pants next time.
Matt, thank you for that. That was a fascinating conversation. I've been so looking forward to this chat.
Pleasure.
And it really, really, I'm sure everyone listening would have loved that. So thank you.
Pleasure.
There you have it, good people. An interview with Mr. Matt Pranick. As always, permit me to wrap up with a request to review Handcut Radio on Apple Podcasts. The moment and seconds it takes makes a massive difference to all of us on the team here. Please note that this podcast is produced by Birch, a marvellous London-based creative agency, and that our superb sound editor is Mr. Joe Boyd. Thank you again for your wonderful support, and I hope we'll see you again next week.